What's up, friends? I hope you guys are having a great summer. It's been beautiful down here in the South where I'm located, and I hope it's beautiful wherever you are. Make sure you hit subscribe wherever you're listening, checking it out, YouTube or Apple or Google or Stitcher or we're everywhere. So just hit subscribe or follow or whatever they do wherever you're listening and whatnot. Follow us on social at MyFi Podcast, or you follow me on social as well at Lee T. Baker on all the platforms, so you can keep up with all the stuff that's going on with MyFi and more. And I'm just glad that you're here. I had a great conversation with my friend Sean Kelly, who's an incredible guitar player. We'll get into everything he's done. We're really talking about his book, Don't Call It Hair Metal, and we'll get all into it. So right now, let's do it. Let's get into it. All right, we're doing it. Show number 32. This is amazing. This has been so fun. I hope you guys are having fun. I hope you're listening. I hope you're sharing the podcast with people. And I hope you're enjoying it, mainly because I enjoy doing it. I enjoy talking about music and getting to talk to these guests. And I love these times we're living in. You can kind of just DM people on Instagram and find interesting people to interview about things they got going on. And it's pretty great. Sean's one of those people. Sean Kelly's an incredible guitar player. He wrote a great book. He's been a part of a lot of incredible bands, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But because his book is called Don't Call It Hair Metal, and he talks about the inspiration of the 80s hard rock, melodic rock, hair metal, whatever you want to call it, I want to talk a little bit about some of my favorite hair metal bands. And I know he says don't call it hair metal, but it is what it is sometimes. You know what I'm saying? I mean, but these bands, super inspiring in my life. That was when I got my first guitar, was like 1990. I was about to turn 11, or 80, 89, Christmas of 89, got my first guitar, electric guitar, and never looked back. I've been playing guitar my whole life. I love it. And a lot of these bands were the bands that I saw as like superheroes, and they were amazing. And maybe you're listening and that's not your genre. Maybe you're into like country or hip hop or anything. And I love every genre for one reason or another. I can find something to love about any kind of music and be inspired by it. And I just think that that's great. I love that we have access to all this music, you know, on the streaming platforms and YouTube and all that sort of stuff. I miss things about the old way the record industry worked for sure. Cause there was some exciting things about that, but I do love that we can just listen to things and learn from things and all that. And so maybe you've never really gotten into hair metal, or maybe you're one of those people who you've heard the term hair metal and just like disregarded it. So I want to talk about a few of my favorite bands. Most of these you've probably heard of, a couple maybe you haven't, especially if you're not in the genre. But I'll give you a couple of reasons why, and you should go check them out. First on the list, Poison. Maybe you've heard of Poison. Nothing but a good time. Every rose has its thorn. They had some huge hits. They just were on the stadium tour with Def Leppard and Motley and Joan Jett. They sold out like 60-something baseball stadiums across the country. They were the first band I ever saw live, first concert I ever went to. And they got labeled the party band. They weren't like known for their talent. But Brett Michaels is an incredible songwriter. The band is as tight as ever. They were incredibly impressive. I saw them on the stadium tour just last June. And CC is an incredible guitar player. So give them a chance. You know what I'm saying? Pull up a Poison record. You know you've heard their stuff before. At least Nothing But a Good Time or Every Rose Has Its Thorn. Get deep in their cuts because there are some really great songs. The Flesh and Blood album is probably my favorite just because of when I found it. In my own musical journey. And so go check that out. Next on the list is Warrant. And I'm going to talk about them a little bit more later. Hint, hint. Warrant is a band that I regrettably never got to see with their original members. Their singer and primary songwriter, Janie Lane, unfortunately passed away a few years ago and had dealt with some troubles and took his own life. And it was a really sad situation. He was a really inspiring guy, an incredible songwriter and frontman. Warrant was an incredibly entertaining band. Their guitar players, Joey Allen and Eric Turner, are both just great players. Warrant's still a band. They have a great singer, Rob, I think is his name. And they're still touring all the time. Great stuff. They've released a couple of newer albums that are great. They're still writing great songs. But they had some hits like Heaven and Sometimes She Cries and Cherry Pie was their probably their biggest hit and a huge record for them. I think that may have been a number one song. And a lot of people don't know this. CC DeVille from Poison actually played the guitar solo on Cherry Pie. So a lot of these bands really work together. Third, Skid Row. I just saw Skid Row recently. They have a new singer as well. Eric something is his name. Phenomenal singer. I do miss that Sebastian's not with them. I wish they were all original because they could be all original. I don't know what went down. But Sebastian Bach, incredible singer. He's doing kind of solo stuff now. Skid Row just released a new record that was produced by Dave Cobb, who Dave works with all kinds of rock bands, country bands. He's an incredible producer, and the new Skid Row album is incredible, and I'm glad that they're still touring doing stuff. Cinderella, one of my favorite bands. They had a big hit with Don't Know What You Got Till It's Gone. Several other hits. Tom Kiefer, the singer from Cinderella, is touring kind of solo, but doing Cinderella stuff. Jeff Labar, the guitar player from Cinderella, passed away about a year or so ago, unfortunately. And so we won't get to see an all original Cinderella. But they were a great band as well. And Tom Kiefer is an incredible guitar player, songwriter. They're actually playing the week that I'm recording this episode. They're going to be in Atlanta with another band that I'm going to mention on the list as well. And I really would love to go see that show. So I may try to make that happen. Who knows? Next on the list, Stryper. Stryper, incredible. Michael Sweet, incredible singer. Saw him about a year ago. They still sound amazing. Vocals are amazing. They're super technical. The guitar harmonies and vocal harmonies and all the things that they seem to be able to pull off are just mind-blowing. And they're all the original guys too. Oz is still with them. Robert playing drums. Now, Perry Richardson's playing bass with them now. Perry Richardson is in the next band I'm going to mention. But he's been with them for like 20 something years, and they're still making incredible albums. They released a record back in 2020 called Even the Devil Believes, which is one of my favorite records of that year. Just incredible, heavy guitar stuff, great songwriting, all that. Next on the list, Firehouse. Maybe you've heard Don't Treat Me Bad or Love of a Lifetime, big hits for them. Perry Richardson from Stryper was the bass player in Firehouse for their first few records. They are an incredible band. They play, but they don't tour as much. They haven't made new music in a while, and I really wish they would press their first two records on vinyl again. I actually got a copy of the first record, which was self-titled, but they had the second record. I think it's called Hold Your Fire. Would love to get my hands on one of those, but they're ridiculously expensive because they haven't been pressed in a while. So you have to find originals, and they're like hundreds of dollars. Now, worth it in some regard, but I really wish they would repress those records. So if somehow this gets to the powers that be with Firehouse, repress your records. Next on the list, Winger. They're the other band that's playing with Cinderella in Atlanta this week. Winger got kind of pigeonholed because of something that happened on Beavis and Butthead. There was like a nerd character on that show, and he used to always wear a Winger shirt, which I never understood because Winger is literally a band full of musical virtuosos. Rob Morgenstein, the drummer, was from the Dixie Dregs, which is an incredible prog rock band. Paul Taylor, the keyboard player and second guitar player, was in Alice Cooper's band, is an incredible progressive rock musician. Reb Beach and Kip Winger were both writing songs and working as session musicians in the New York area when they formed Winger. Incredible songwriters in their own right. Reb's been in Whitesnake and played with pop stars and all this. Kip has classical music awards he's won and symphonies he's orchestrated. They are brilliant musicians. And for some reason, they got really pigeonholed because of that Beavis and Butthead thing in the early 90s. And I think there was like in one of the Metallica videos, Lars like is throwing darts at a picture of Kip Winger, and like people just started making fun of him, and they lost their credibility for a hot minute. And in the 90s, I guess if you lost it for a hot minute, you lost it. And which was unfortunate because Winger is one of my favorite bands and incredibly talented. And last on the list, White Lion. White Lion's a great band from the Northeast. Vito Brada, their guitar player, was great, great, great. They had a huge hit with When the Children Cry. All those guys are still around. Mike Tramp, the singer, just released a White Lion like reimagined songs record this year. And it's really great. I really hope they would get back together and do something. Vito really hasn't been in the public eye for like 30 years. He just kind of disappeared. And just recently, he's just been doing interviews again for a couple of books and things. And my record of the week, I said I was going to talk about Warrant a little more later, but the record of the episode is Warrant Dog Eat Dog. I managed to get my hands on a copy of this, thanks to my friend Scott, who owns a great record store in Shreveport, Louisiana, called The Little Shop of Music. You should check it out if you're ever in North Louisiana. But this Warrant Dog Eat Dog album reminds me of something with all these 80s guys. So like a lot of these 80s bands, they made some of their best records kind of after the fact, because the music genre was sort of moving on. Nirvana had hit and all that stuff had happened. But Dog Eat Dog is not, it's not a party album. It's not your typical, what you think of like 80s party songs and power ballads and what, I mean, there's some power ballad stuff on there, but it's really thoughtfully written, incredible stuff. And I think it was the last stuff that Janie Lane worked on. Great riffs, great songs, incredible record, cover to cover, really rich, thematically, and, kind of dark. At least the first half of it, is, but an incredible record. Now let's get to Sean Kelly, and, let's get to why you can't call it hair metal anymore. So my guest this week is my friend Sean Kelly. He is an incredible guitar player. He has a lot of credits, to go over. He's played guitar for Nelly Furtado, pop superstar from Canada. He plays with, a band that was born in the early 80s called Coney Hatch. It's a great band. An artist named Lee Aaron, who's incredible. Her records are great. He has his own band called Crash Kelly, and all their records are up on, streaming services, but they haven't done, Crash Kelly hasn't done anything in a little while, but you should still go, listen to those records because they're really great. And, Sean's just been around, man. He was in Helix, which is a great 80s band, but all these bands are still playing. And Sean's an educator. He works as an elementary school music teacher. He's just a thoughtful, incredibly kind, great dude. We had an incredible conversation. This is his book, Don't Call It Hair Metal. You can, pick it up. Put some links in the description. You can pick it up on Amazon or whatever. There's also a link to one where you can get an autographed copy, from Sean himself. And I don't think it costs any more money either. And so if you want to get one autographed from Sean, that'd be dope. So check out the book. You can follow him at Sean Kelly Guitar on all the, social media outlets and whatnot. And, yeah, keep up with what he's got going on. But for right now, I hope you enjoyed this conversation I had with my friend, Sean Kelly. Sean Kelly, how are you, man?
I'm doing greatly. How are you?
Dude, it's really, really great to meet you. I have been just loving the book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Great to meet you too.
Yeah, yeah. I got it just a few days ago, and I'm probably about 100 pages in. And I have to tell you, like, immediately, I don't know how, if people skip like the forward or the beginning of the book and jump right in, but I hope they don't, because the story about how this music impacted you and how it's connected to your dad is just really, really deep, man, and really rich.
Oh, well, yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's, you know, that's, you know, a big reason why I wrote this book, right? A lot of times I think that rock music in the 80s gets relegated to a kind of, a lighter place. And sometimes that's totally appropriate, but I don't think that the artist should be relegated to a lighter or lesser place, because, many of them are still continuing to make great music to this day. Totally. And certainly that music has stayed with me all my life. I've never grown out of hard rock, be it hard rock that was written and recorded in the 80s or the artist who continued to create. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, it hit me personally. The first show I ever saw, the first concert I ever went to, I got my first guitar for Christmas. And then that March after that, my dad took me to see Poison and Slaughter on the Flesh and Blood tour, for my birthday.
Amazing.
And I was with my dad, and he's always loved, you know, heavy music and stuff too. And, you know, the 80s stuff and classic rock stuff and everything. So it just really hit me that it was connected. And I love when people share the richness behind it. So I just thought that was a great way to start the book.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you appreciated it.
Yeah, man. So you're in Toronto. Is that where you're from originally?
I'm originally from, I was born in a place called North Bay, Ontario, and I lived in a smaller town called Temiskaming, Quebec, moved back to North Bay. I'm a North Bay boy, really, but I've been in Toronto since 1991.
Nice, man. And I know you mentioned a little bit about your dad, but for those who haven't read the book, just his connection to music. Did you grow up like in a musical household? Did your family play music?
Not really. My mother loved music. My dad loved music too. He loved country music, but my mom played a little piano and she sang in choirs, was very supportive, but, no, I'm really the kind of first person who pursued it seriously in my immediate family. But we were a hockey family. My dad was a hockey player. Yeah. And many uncles who played in the NHL and the AHL and the Eastern League and the hockey gene kind of skipped me. As a hockey player, I'm not a bad guitar player. You know? The Atlanta Flames aren't calling me anytime soon.
No.
But I had the hockey cards.
Nice. Well, how did you end up in music then? You got a hockey background. Nobody really, played an instrument, I guess, per se.
No, it bit me. I like many kids, I remember the first purchase I ever bought with my own money was the Pointer Sisters, Jump for My Love.
Oh, yeah.
I needed to own that song. Then there was Gloria by Laura Branigan. There was kind of these pop songs that just spoke to me melodically where I wanted to listen to them over and over again. I Love Rock and Roll by Joan Jett. But then I started to curate an identity with, artists. So all of a sudden when I heard Quiet Riot, Come On, Feel the Noise, I wanted to know about the band that was making this sound. When I heard Pyromania by Def Leppard, same thing. But it was Twisted Sister. When I heard We're Not Gonna Take It, that's when I knew I wanted to be a part of this. I needed to do this, whatever this was. Because at that point, this was, guys who look like linebackers dressed as women. Why do I want to be this? I don't know, but I need to do this. Yeah. I need to be a part of this. So that was it. It was just the power of that song, Oh, We're Not Going to Take It, that really inspired me to want to get a guitar, make the sound, and go for it.
Yeah. I don't know if things got around like they do now. And the only reason I know is because I've read some things about the history of the band, but like Twisted Sister, like they had a tough go of it. Like they really had to work to get where they got,
Yeah, they were a very successful like club band in a time in the tri-state, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, when there was a healthy bar scene, and they would go but in terms of getting recognized by the record industry, by all accounts, very difficult. Like, they were a band that was playing in front of 3,000 people and on any given night, and still couldn't attract record company interest, had to work and claw tooth and nail for any breaks they got, and kind of took it to the wire where they were almost totally exhausted before they got a deal with a label in England. And that kind of set off the trajectory of their success. But yeah, they, the work ethic was unparalleled.
Yeah. I remember a lot like you. I saw a video when MTV came out. Somebody was over. I vaguely remember like my parents were out, so we had a babysitter, and she must have been a teenager or something. She turns on MTV and I'm like, what is this? And she's like, oh, it's a channel that just plays music. And I was like, oh, that sounds cool. I don't know. I must have been like 5 years old. But I remember the Scorpions' Rock You Like a Hurricane, vividly. And I remember having a thought like, these guys are like superheroes. Like they're in costume, but when you only see that, like back then, you really think like, these guys they're superheroes,
Totally. Well, in fact, it's funny you mention that, because really there was a succession of people who I saw as being extraordinary, right? I kind of went from superheroes to Star Wars to hockey players to rock musicians.
Yeah.
So, you're always looking, you always want something to aspire to, right? But really, except for the hockey player part, rock stars kind of are a combination of superheroes and Star Wars, right? At least 80s rock was,
Yeah.
I can relate to that. And there was that visual aspect where really 80s hard rock kind of showed you how to listen in a lot of ways. Like bang your head. You're literally getting a direction from Quiet Riot on what to do when listening to this music. You bang your head, I think that's a pretty interesting point.
Yeah, there was something about And you make this, like I said, I'm about 100 pages into the book, and I've just gotten into the conversation that you bring up in interviewing some guys like Todd Kearns, who's actually been on the podcast before, and Paul Gilbert and some people early in the book. And it's known as hair metal. People have said that before, and it was like flamboyant in like the outfits and the stage, you know, design and all that, whether that was like an offshoot, you know, of what Kiss was doing and inspiring people in the 70s and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
There was so much talent involved in the people who were playing this music, arguably one of the most pivotal, you know, points in music history, particularly for guitar players, right?
100%. Like, I mean, the innovations that happen in guitar in the 80s, and starting with Eddie Van Halen, I think it's a pretty unparalleled jump, you know, especially with all the technical innovations and the focus on the importance of the guitar solo, you know? Mm-hmm. It got to the point where bands were getting signed on the strength of their guitar player.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember distinctly finding spots on a docking cassette where I knew the guitar solos were. I wasn't necessarily all that interested in the song. Not always. I mean, I love a lot of Dawkins songs, and Don Dawkins is a great songwriter.
Sure.
But really, and Jeff Pilson and George, they're all great writers. But I was really interested. Like, it took on a greater importance. And it's funny, I realize now, I still kind of listen like that. I still kind of, in the hierarchy of parts of a song, the opening riff is still very important to me. I kind of, as a songwriter myself, I write from that place. It's funny. I work with, play with an artist named Lee Aaron, and that band, we all write together. Nice. And Dave Reimer, the bass player, dear friend of mine and an incredible songwriter, you know, he's a real song guy. Like he's coming out of like, he likes the Carpenters. He likes Jellyfish. He's listening to the Smithereens. So he's thinking of this the whole song, like the way most people listen. But I realize it's like, well, I kind of think about it, the importance of the guitar riff. And that was an important part of 80s rock. The riff in Round and Round is just as important as the chorus or Lay It Down. Yeah. The riff in Girls, 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 you know, is that Tom Werman, the producer Tom Werman used to say, I'm looking for a guitar hook. That's the thing I want. That's what he used to hook the listener in. Now it might be the sound of a drum machine or a synth line. But back then it was a guitar hook that got people in. And I think there's a certain type of energy that's unique to 80s rock that has that, you know, like where that guitar part has such prominence, you know?
Yeah, there was something about the whole genre. I was trying to tell my kids this the other day. My daughter really loves 80s stuff. She's about to be 13, and she loves all the 80s bands. And I just took her to see Kiss with me last fall. And, you know, she's, you know, into all this. We've seen Striper together, all this. And,
great band.
Yeah. Oh man. They were phenomenal. They sounded amazing. We just saw them like a year, almost exactly a year ago. Unbelievable. Sound like
we just played with them on the Monsters of Rock cruise and I went to watch them and I was like, this is mind blowingly tight. Like it's that they can play that intricate guitar style and then go right into vocal harmonies while they're both hitting the lead. Unbelievable.
Yeah, Michael Sweet's a beast. He just did that new record, the new Sweet Lynch record that's really great, too. He's a great songwriter.
Yeah, sure is.
Yeah, but what you were saying, there was something, I was talking to my kids about this music and what makes it different. And to me, how melodic and anthemic and storytelling it was in nature was always so like inspiring and hopeful. And I listened back to all those records and it still gives me that same feeling. And I'm glad, same as you, that there are still bands now, not just 80s bands who are still making records in their genre, but even new bands in what people call like the 80s rock or melodic rock genre. There's new bands doing great things in that genre too. Now I haven't gotten to the end of the book, but are there bands that maybe you mentioned in the book, but bands that you're into now that are younger and doing new stuff like that?
You know, I know there are. I know there's a lot of amazing bands. Like I know Classless Act is that's one that's out there on the stadium tour. I like you know, they're not a new band, but like Rival Sons out there doing great things. I know there are so many bands. Actually, the one that I love, it's more of a prog rock thing. They're more like Rush inspired. Is Crownlands, a band called Crownlands?
I never heard of them.
Oh well worth checking out. Canadian duo. Absolutely unbelievable. But yeah, I'll be honest. My listening these days, like I really do kind of stick to 70s and 80s rock. Mm-hmm. And then I look to find out as much about all of those bands as I can. And I've kind of, that's where my listening time goes. I'm fairly active musician and educator. And yeah. So I'm pretty busy. So I don't have a chance to listen as much as I'd like to. So I'm sure that there are some incredible bands. We played with a couple of, Reckless Love was one. There's a, I just ran in. We just played Sweden Rock with a band I play in Coney Hatch, Chez Kane. She's another girl who's out there doing great nice. Things. Yeah, so there's lots of amazing artists and more than we think, right? We tend to think, oh, there's no more good rock music. There are more people being inspired by more music now than ever. It's just everything is smaller tail and everything's more focused. You might not.
Great point.
There's not the gatekeepers who create a pipeline that goes to the masses. Now the masses have the opportunity to pick and choose what they want. And I see that. I'm a elementary school music teacher. I see that with my students. I just did a listening analysis assignment with them. And I said, pick three songs. And one kid had picked like Dream On. And then he picked a Drake song. And then he picked, Tutti Frutti by Little Richard. You know, like,
yeah.
And I'm just like, why'd you pick these? And the answer was great, because I like them.
Yeah.
And he's found them through different things, right? So, you know, I think that we're listening different, we're taking things in differently, and it's just a different music marketplace out there.
Yeah, which seems like it makes it wide open, you know, for a lot of creativity.
It is. And you know, it's hard not to miss the days when there were gatekeepers and where... You know, it was more lucrative at one point to make records. I know there's still, we're very lucky in the classic rock world. We can still go out on these multi-band festivals and bills and get paid well. And there are opportunities out there. But those opportunities exist because at one point, millions of dollars of marketing was sunk in, right? And and brands were created, right? Like, and that's something that's harder to create right now, where it's mass brand identity. I mean, the internet hasn't wiped out the popularity of, Diet Coke. You know, we all know what that is. Yeah. You know, like it, people will still want that one thing, or maybe that's their preferred thing. But with music, because we've devalued it in a way fiscally, you know, and it's so easy to attain, we tend to pick and choose and not attach the same emotional connectivity to different brands.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny you say brands. Like, I remember I was having a conversation with a guy recently about like band logos.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see those like you used to anymore. Like, I remember drawing like AC/DC and Poison on my notebook, you know, when I was in middle school and high school and whatever. And you just don't see that level of, I don't know if it's fandom, at least that level of branding around bands, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, the thing is, you can go online and you could go on a Bandcamp, you know? Do you know, you're familiar with the platform band? You could go on Bandcamp and search 80s rock, and they will all have, you'll see a ton of new bands with logos that look like a Van Halen or a Rat logo or anything.
Yeah.
But like they've copied the aesthetic, and we all have access to the tools to create.
Yeah.
On the laptop I'm talking to you on, this is also my recording studio where I can make a record that, you know, well, I don't have Bo Hill's ears or mixing abilities by any stretch or musicality. I do have the tools to make it sound pretty close to a Bo Hill record from the 80s if I wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, so we have that and we can graphic design and we can see and draw influence. But yeah, you're right. In terms of what that brand means to people and the amount of people who focus energy and intention onto that brand, like Kiss or Motley Crue or Van Halen, it's different. And it's funny, I was just having a chat with Coney Hatch, one of some of the band members I play with, and we're talking about t-shirt designs, and I'm the new guy in the band. They've been going since 1982, but I was a fan of the band.
Oh,
and
nice.
And we're talking about t-shirts. I'm going, guys, these are great, but I want to see that Coney Hatch logo.
Yeah.
The first thing I did when I joined the band was got Coney Hatch picks. I wanted to see the logo and my name on the back
because man.
I'm in this band. This band is a brand I identify with, right?
Yeah, that's amazing, man. So
I'm very passionate about that.
Were they on Coney Hatch on the Monsters of Rock cruise, or was it the Swedish?
That was Lee Aaron was on the Monsters of Rock cruise. Okay. We just got back from playing Sweden Rock, which was a massive festival. Def Leppard, Motley Crue, Iron Maiden, Pantera, TNT, Ghost, Deep Purple, Blue Oyster Cult. It's absolutely my Europe. Wow. It was mind blowing. And for me, the highlight of that whole trip was our dressing room, or our little dressing room area, was right beside TNT's, and Ronnie Lee Tecro is one of my all-time favorite guitar players. So I got to hang out with him a little bit. And I got to another connection I made with a really great guy, with Mike Tramp from White Lion. And you know, it's nice that you get a chance to kind of rub shoulders with people who inspired you and influenced you and peers, and then also go up and play in front of, you know, tens of thousands of diehard rock fans. Like, I mean, pretty amazing.
Yeah, dude. I want to ask you a couple things. I want to ask you, like, what really just made you write the book. But before we get to that, on the Monsters of Rock cruise, because I've seen lots of videos, who just really blew your mind? Because I'm sure you got to watch all the bands too, but who just really blew you away?
Absolutely. There was a few. Kix. I'm a huge Kix fan. Nice. So to finally see them live was a thrill. And I interviewed Brian Forsythe in my book. So that was great. Extreme. Mm-hmm. I got to see Nuno play for the first time, that Rise solo live right in front of my face. And I don't know why I play guitar. The world does not need me playing guitar. Nuno's got it covered. You know, Nuno is the heir apparent to Eddie Van Halen. He is the guy. So he was amazing. Striper, as I mentioned, just wonderful. And then some other bands that were really, like Faster Pussycat, absolutely incredible rock and roll set. A band called DAD, Disney After Dark, European band, amazing. There were so many. Winger, world class. I took in as many bands as I could. George Lynch, great to see George Lynch and Lynch Mob. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Chris Holmes from Wasp. What a lovely guy. I got a chance to spend some time and thank him for the influence he had on me. And man, he's doing great. And he's an inspiration, and out there still doing it and getting, you know, really kind of resurrecting his career and resurrecting himself. And what a music lover. And this is guy, I don't think people realize the depth of his history in the LA music scene. This is a friend and contemporary of Eddie Van Halen in the 70s. Yeah. I mean, Eddie's used Chris's guitar on Women and Children First. That's a connection to, you know, that early 70s, or sorry, I guess mid to late 70s California scene that inspired the whole thing. Chris was right there, and we got to sit and watch George Lynch play together. I thought that was a real thrill. Felt all connected. So lots of great memories on Monsters of Rock and Sweden Rock. Incredible.
That's amazing, dude. You mentioned Nuno. I saw that same year that my dad took me to see Poison and Slaughter. Later that year, we saw Extreme open for ZZ Top on the Recycler tour.
Oh, wow.
And so that was like the height of, you know, More Than Words and all that stuff for Extreme. They were just breaking. So I got to see Nuno. I saw him years later on a guitar kind of virtuoso tour. But when that Rise solo hit, I saw like press about guitar like I hadn't seen in a really long time. The Rick Beato interview that Nuno did, which was amazing. Seeing Nuno on the stage at the Super Bowl with Rihanna. You know, just that somebody like him seems to be having maybe the biggest moment of his, I mean, he's had some great moments and I know people love him, but it's almost like he's having the biggest moment of his career, maybe even right now as a guitar player, maybe not Extreme as a band.
Yeah.
But people are paying attention to guitar like I haven't seen in a while. And it's kind of in the press a little bit more. Like I saw Rolling Stone did an article on Extreme and like a couple other things. That's just crazy to me, but awesome.
You know, well, yeah. Time. I mean, it's, you know, I had people who I know are not hard rock fans sending me this link with this solo. Like he kind of somehow crossed, you know, that line between diehard niche fans and just music lovers or just the general public, where he's associated with great guitar. Yeah. And that's there's no secret to that. He played a solo that had enough emotional connectivity and technical brilliance and rhythmic innovation, whatever you want to say. He had the right ingredients of things, and it transcended all the information that's coming at us constantly. Something about that solo transcended and touched us and touched people. And that's why that happened, right? Like, so that's just, that's cultural zeitgeist, right? Like, that's just like one of those magic moments. And I just listened to that Extreme record. And part of the reason why I wrote this book was I wanted to show that there is diversity and artistic intention in the best of 80s hard rock. There's a couple of songs that kind of harken back to an older Extreme vibe or a kind of more classic 80s rock vibe, but a lot of it does not.
Yeah,
a lot of it, there's country, there's some hip hop influence, there's funk influence, pop influence, and it's amazing. But it's funny, all through that, there's a strand of Nuno burning solos because he's feeling like he has to carry this forward. He's carrying forward this tradition of the lead guitar aesthete, you know? I think he is.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a great way to put it. I think that I don't think it's from the interviews I've seen, I don't think it's pressure. I think he's so passionate about guitar and seeing it move forward. And these are not by all means equal. At least we don't see it this way now. We probably won't because this is a monumental moment. But like when Eruption hit and everybody saw the electric guitar differently from that moment on. I hope that this generation has a moment like that with the guitar, because I think that the generation before, like the boomer generation, had that moment maybe with Elvis, seeing him with a guitar, you know, and then in the 70s, I'm sure there were moments for people with like Led Zeppelin and people like that. And then in the 80s or Hendrix at Woodstock, you know, national anthem, whatever, like just monumental guitar moments. And I don't know. I mean, you can't compare Rise yet or that solo or what it's done pop culture wise to any of that yet, but I hope that it has some sort of effect on, you know, rekindling people's passion for like guitar and hard rock guitar and what it can do and how expressive the instrument is.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think it's alive and well in the people who are passionate about playing guitar, because let me explain that. I was just at a music trade show. Well, you know, one of those shows where there's a million people playing guitars and there's gear people.
And,
it was like a Canadian version of that. And I was walking by and I saw some buddies who worked at booths, but I'm in there. I'm listening to 12-year-old kids ripping Warren Demartini solos. Like, and it's like, how do you know that? Well, they know it because it's all out there. The world's music's at their fingertips and they've attached themselves to this hobby or this passion. And this is what they do, you know, like this is just something they do. And it's almost more in a classic sense, like a kid who took classical piano. Well, now they take classical Warren Demartini lessons and they learn that very well and can execute it at a very high level because there's all that information out there. There's a seat, you know, there's decades of teachers who have learned that and passed on the tradition. Mm-hmm. And it becomes something more akin to that. So I think it's less about, we're going to see less massive worldwide, this is life-changing for everybody, and more, this is life-changing for smaller groups, but the impact will carry on just as strong. There's just going to be more impactful things that happen at a smaller scale.
That's great.
Maybe.
That's great. No, I believe you, man. Talk a little bit about what made you write the book. I mean, I know you mentioned something a minute ago, but I want to hear the heart of it because I'm enjoying it, man.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you are. The heart of it was that I get frustrated as a creator who loves playing in lots of different genres. I love all kinds of different music. I studied classical guitar. I played on country records. I'm a terrible jazz player, but I love it. you know, I play lots of different styles, and I played with pop art. I played with Nelly Furtado for 10 years. Like, you know, I played with pop. I've done the pop thing. But I am very passionate about music, and it hurt me when I would bring up, if I'd say, hey, man, check out this riff. It's kind of like Cinderella. And someone would say, oh, Cinderella's cheese. That's a hair band. I'm going, yeah, but if I would have said the same thing was inspired by Aerosmith or Led Zeppelin, you would have thought that was cool.
Yeah.
And that bothered me. And I felt that a lot of times those artists got short shrift on the creative side. And I said, why do I have to camouflage my influence in order to gain credibility? That bothered me.
Man.
And I found that that was something I would do. I found myself doing it. And I said, no, this isn't right. In the greater tapestry of the rock and roll story, the best of 80s rock is every bit as good as the best of 70s rock, 60s rock, 50s rock. Yeah. And it all kind of fell under this pejorative label called hair metal, which came long after the fact, came after market. It was a facile way for journalists to lump in, you know, music of a genre. And I don't know, to me, to compare Cinderella or Poison is not appropriate on a musical level. I find that those are different flavors, just like Faster Pussycat or Winger are. And neither's better, neither's worse. They are different. And to me, that speaks to the diversity in the genre that is often overlooked. Now, there's reasons that are valid why it's often overlooked, because it was also the dawn of the conglomeration of record industries, right? Of record companies. So all of a sudden, you've got what used to once be run by a music man, by your Ahmet Erdogans, you know, or your Herb Alperts. Yeah. You've got now a conglomerate that has to be responsible to shareholders. And it's more about selling units. And yeah. You sell units by doing market research and finding out what people are buying and then refining your product to the point where every label had to have a W band. Hey, we need a White Lion. We need a Winger. We need a Warrant. We need a White Snake. Oh. You know, W sells. We got, wow. Hey, what? We're all wearing white leather now. Hey, who's that person who does that? Who does the hair? We need everyone to have hair like that. We need a power ballad. We need the same producer. And everything got refined to the point where they were just signing anybody who had long hair and they found on the Sunset Strip. Yeah. And then prepackaging it with other musicians actually playing the parts and other people writing the songs, throwing it out, and it starts to lose its soul. And that did happen to a degree. That does, but at the same time, a lot of those bands still had dreams and talent and ability. And so I tend to look at it as I wanted to find the humanity in the 80s rock story and speak to the artistic intention and the sonic evolution. And really, it was personal. It's like, I've stayed with this music my whole life. I don't think I'm an idiot. I mean, other people would argue maybe I am, and that's fair, but I don't think I'm an idiot. Like, why do I care about this? And why does it hurt me when people don't value or respect my music the way I respect the music they like? I love power pop. I'm a music fan. I am a music junkie.
Same.
I love all kinds of music, but I want my favorite music to be as respected as theirs. So I think there was a bit of a personal issue, but really at the end of the day, I abandoned that premise of trying to shove academia down people's throats. Like, I mean, music is subjective and music touches you the way it touches you. And I just wanted to show you, I thought the best way to do that would be through artist voice, by interviewing people and having them share their stories. And by just kind of pointing out that, you know, music is subjective. We're all listeners, but, you know, maybe we shouldn't be so quick to lump things all under one umbrella. There, you know, take a look under the hood. There's a lot of good stuff underneath the hood of 80s hard rock.
Totally, man. Absolutely. Was there somebody that you met through interviewing during the book and stuff that maybe you knew but never really got a chance to talk to, that was just a great interview and great addition to the book?
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of people. Like Mark Slaughter was incredibly articulate and generous with his time and you know, really spoke to, like, you know, I think it's fair to say that a lot of people would kind of up all night, sleep all day, that's the hair metal ethos, yeah, kind of dismiss it. But Mark Slaughter is an incredibly articulate and highly trained musician who came from a deep love of music in his youth. He told me some very surprising things about his background. And that was edifying, right? Where it and his whole approach and his whole inspiration, and he was an inspiring guy to talk to. Paul Gilbert brought up some real good things that actually challenged my perception of things. What I won't say too much. I want people to read it in the book. But like Paul had a wonderful perspective. Scotty Hill from Skid Row. I mean, everybody who contributed brought something very valuable to the table. It was really great to talk to guys like Mike Fraser, who were responsible for the recording of so many of these albums at Little Mountain Sound. He was fantastic. Dee Snider, you know, who is an absolute music authority. he was great. Rudy Sarzo, who'd been through so many different bands, and actually really is a child of the, you know, he was there before rock and roll was born, you know, like he was, you know, a child of the 60s, 70s who found his success in the 80s, but really was coming at it from that perspective. It was interesting to see Rick Emmett from Tribe. So many of them had different perspectives. And really, I think that speaks to what I'm talking about with the diversity. Like, I mean, these guys all have different perceptions and different different prisms through which they see their creativity.
Yeah. And, you know, people relocated to LA, but like, it really was like a whole nationwide thing. Like there was like the Cinderella, Bon Jovi, Skid Row, East Coast thing. And there was
Kicks.
A West Coast. Yeah. Kicks. Like there was so much of it. And a lot of these guys have really rich musical backgrounds, like Kip Winger, you know, and Reb Beach, who were, you know, doing session work. And, you know, Kip is an incredible classical musician and composer. Yeah. And, you know, guys like Yngwie, who came from the whole neoclassical background of music, like they're not just mindless shredding going on. Like you had to be, for the most part, you had to be a really well schooled and knowledgeable player to contribute really deeply in this style of music, because for guitar it was so complex. Not to say it wasn't for other instruments, because there were some great drummers and bass players and keys players and stuff too, but it seemed like this whole genre was just, it was a guitar genre and it was really complex for guitar players.
It was. And you know what was interesting was, to me, what was cool about that whole kind of neoclassical thing and the whole Shrapnel Records stable of artists, it actually had a lot to do with punk to me and new wave of British heavy metal, in that it was a do-it-yourself ethos. These were not major label budget records.
Totally.
This was kind of, we got 3 days in the studio, we got to figure this out. And I think that that created a cachet that was probably similar to what people felt with punk, right? Like to me, it was very inspiring. I would buy a guitar magazine. I before I ever heard a Vinnie Moore record, I knew everything about Vinnie Moore from reading guitar ads, and Ibanez ad, and reading the articles, right? I thought that was really cool that I found it. I had to really dig to go find a record, you know, a Shrapnel record. I remember the first time I went on a school trip to Paris, and I was 16, and I went into a Virgin Megastore there, and oh, they had all those records. I packed my suitcase so full of Shrapnel records. Couldn't awesome. Get the friggin' thing closed, you know? But they were all there. I spent all my money. I couldn't eat, but it's okay.
Worth it.
Worth it. And but you're absolutely right. And that ability to play was, it was something to aspire to, right? Like, and I could definitely see where it got carried away. Like, I mean, to the point where maybe the technique overcame the melody, you know, some people would argue differently, but yeah, but it was kind of cool to see how parts of that were appropriated and put into, you know, the pop world. All of a sudden a Cher song might have a solo with finger tapping in it or something. You know what I mean? I thought that was kind of neat.
Totally. So, yeah. And I think that has come back a little bit. Like there's guys now, like modern, I would say, they have a similar talent, but talent level, but because the music landscape is different, there are guitar players like, I saw Mateus Asado, who's a young, incredible guitar player who was on stage with Extreme the other day. And because of Instagram, these guys can get on and showcase their talent and then get picked up. Who's it? Justin? Oh my gosh. What's his name? He's been with Pink for so long.
Derrico.
Yeah. Incredible player. Oh my gosh. Like, and there are people like younger players who are doing it, you know, and they're getting highlighted because, like Mateus has been with, Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak and Silk Sonic for the last year or so. And they're getting all these like session gigs and live gigs and all that sort of stuff, because they're just, people want players, and it just harkens back to that, you know, ability and things of the 80s. You know?
And also that speaks to the cool part about the democratization that's happened in music with the internet, where somebody can now go up and find an audience. It's a little harder. Maybe there's more people, more salmon going down the chute, right? But, but you know, the bigger one's going to make its way through, right? Like it's, you know, it still kind of happens.
Totally.
And, you know, it's like my cousin was a scout for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and he's, I remember someone was asking him, oh, you know, what program should I go in to get my kid? He goes, don't worry, I'll find you skating on a pond in Northern Ontario somewhere if you're any good. I'll find you.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we get the talent, you know, the cream rises to the top, maybe.
That's true. That's true, man. Well, I always get to this point with every guest in the show because I always want to know, what's your three, Sean Kelly's three desert island albums, your three biggest albums? I know everybody does that too, but it's always helpful because I usually pick up something I've never heard before. And if it's meaningful to people, I always want to check it out.
Yeah, man. Well, geez, I don't know. This can change on any given day, but you know what? I'll start with, I'm going to go most played. Okay. 5150 Van Halen.
Not a popular opinion, but that's my favorite Van Halen album.
The Sammy Hagar era was my Van Halen. It was the first concert I ever saw in a major, first major concert I ever saw, like in a huge stadium, was Van Halen on 5150. And that summer, that was when music just kind of hit me on a social level.
Yeah.
Where it was part of my social identity. I was going out and, you know, first kisses and dirt biking with your friends and all that. And that was just the soundtrack of that kind of awakening, right?
That's awesome.
So that's one. And also, I mean, I love the songs and I love the looseness of that. People say, oh, it's so polished and pop. That record's, it sounds like a garage record. They're all whacked out of their minds and poor Mick Jones trying to control, like, Sammy Hagar's in with these lunatics. Like, it's pretty punk rock to me. Yeah. Sounds weird, but I don't care. I think I like it because it sounds weird. I think I like it because it's got weird Simmons drums and Eddie's guitar tone is a little out of whack. I mean, they made it in basically a shed. 5150, I think, was just like basically a clubhouse. So anyway, that one. Geez, man. I'll go Thin Lizzy, Live and Dangerous.
Nice.
Just because it's such a wonderful collection of everything I love about hard rock. There's class, there's romanticism, incredible playing. And, I'm stuck on the desert island. I'm going to kick myself if I miss, I don't know. What do I got there? Let's go Too Fast for Love, Motley Crue.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Like, I mean, it's what a dirtbag of a record, but I love it. That record, you know, Shout at the Devil scared me as a kid because I thought, on a supernatural level. But when I heard Too Fast for Love, I was scared on a very real level. Like, I mean, these are horrible human beings. And it even sounded like that from the way they played the riffs. I said, these are bad people who I never want to meet, but I am compelled to listen to. It was like, you know, you go to an arcade and you used to play pinball and there'd be the big kid with the leather jacket, maybe the April Wine back patch. He'd be spitting on you. And I was like, you want to kick your ass. You have to stay away from him, but you kind of want to hang out with him too. That's what Motley Crue was.
Yeah, that's Motley. Yeah,
they're the bully that you kind of want to be friends with.
Yeah, dude. Man, that's awesome. Sean, I appreciate the time, man. Thanks for writing the book. I can't wait to finish it.
If you're
listening, go buy the book. It's called Don't Call It Hair Metal. It's everywhere. I'm sure Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you need to buy it online. You can get is there a better place that I can put a link in to get? Are you still doing the autograph copy? Copies or anything?
Yeah, you can get if you go to rockpapermerch.com and look under Sean Kelly, you can get an autographed copy there. But you know what, man, go to a local indie bookstore. You know, go pick it up. Maybe it's sitting there. But I know it's at all the major stores, and I've been getting emails from people all over the world who've been able to pick it up, and certainly all Barnes and Nobles, your Amazons, your Indigo Books in Canada.
Yeah,
wherever you find your books.
Well, go pick it up. Follow at Sean Kelly Guitar on all the social stuff and keep up with everything Sean's got going on. He plays with a million different bands and he's always out there doing stuff and educating young folks on the perils and wonders of rock and roll guitar. And so, man, we appreciate you. I appreciate the time, Sean. You have a good one.
Thanks, Lee. Great talking to you.
Great, great chat with my friend Sean Kelly, incredible guitar player, really, really nice dude, and a fantastic author. Please make sure to go check out his book if you like reading music history sort of literature and learning about things. There's some incredible interviews. It reads really fast. I mentioned on the episode, I'm just about 100 or so pages into it and smoking through it. It's a great book. Some incredible interviews with people that you'll love hearing from. Scotty Hill from Skid Row, Paul Gilbert from Mr. Big, Todd Kearns, who's an incredible Canadian musician and has been on the show before, and loads of other people. So go check out the book and make sure to follow Sean at Sean Kelly Guitar on Instagram for all that's going on. Make sure to follow at MyFi Podcast. You can also follow me at Lee T. Baker. Check out MyFiPodcast.com for all the things that are going on. We got some great episodes coming up. And we've had some great ones over the past couple of months. Sid Seth, a great pop star who's living in New York City, originally from India. That was an incredible episode. Rolling Stone India did an article on him not too long ago that was fantastic. My friend Aslan Freeman, who's a music director for Lainey Wilson, who's a mega country superstar right now, as well as my friend Gabe Larson, who fronts a band called Waldemar, who was just on CBS Saturday Morning and had a great performance on that show. Make sure you go check out all the episodes and follow all these great people and learn about all this great music. But until next time, you guys have a good one.